You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Hi, Canada. Happy Tuesday. Happy Tuesday to everybody. We are... Lots going on today, not just in the election, but all over the world. I hope you're well. Hope your loved ones are well. Hope you're getting back to school. Everything's busy. I want to talk about something that I reflected on based on some feedback I got from you yesterday to open our show. And a lot of it has to do with two issues. How to handle anti-vaxxers as the protests around health facilities like hospitals dominated the headlines. And one side said, Evan, you got to be tough on these people. And the other side saying, if you're tough on them, then you exacerbate the divisions. And I was trying to figure out how to do this. Justin Trudeau is saying, he's on the campaign trail, even right now, saying, you know, vaccine mandates for passports from all my candidates. You need a proof of vaccination if you want to get on a plane, train, or bus. Aaron O'Toole says, look, let's respect people, not divide them. And if you don't want to get a vaccine, even if you're a member of my party, just get tested. And when people are wondering, what's the right way? On one hand, people say, Trudeau's dividing everything. He's using this as a wedge issue, and he's inflaming it because we've seen the rise of these protests and the rise of the People's Party of Canada, who are using this anger for their own popularity. And the others are saying, Mr. O'Toole is exacerbating it because he can't even take a clear stance on vaccines in the middle of a pandemic. So which is it? And how do we figure this out? It's easy for anybody to stick their flag in the ground and just take a strong stance. And you probably are listening saying, no, Evan, if you don't say vaccines, if you don't support vaccine passports, you're an idiot because the data is overwhelming. Or if you do that, you've trampled on human rights and you're not listening to anyone and you shut out voices and we know what you're talking about. I thought about this. Because it's understandably very polarizing. And elections are becoming polarized. It's the first time, and I've covered a lot of elections. I love a passionate debate. I don't mind it. I don't mind negative ads. I'm not going to pretend I'm some kind of, oh my gosh, they're being mean to each other. This is so great. I get it. I like a passionate discussion. But there is a distinction in a society where we have differences and divisions. And that's what I want to talk about today. A difference versus a division. Politics at its best is about difference. You have a view. She has a view. They have a view. I have a view. We have different views. Pick a topic. And this show is all about difference. This show is about difference. You want to have a different view on the size of government. You have a different view on the deficit, a different view on public-private health care, a different view on abortion, a different view on education, a different view on taxes, a different view on medicine. I get it. Differences are what democracies are built on. The accommodation and the freedom to express your difference. I have no issue with that. I welcome it. On this program, I don't try to shove a view down your... I like people having different views. There's not a one answer. As they say in Ecclesiastes, all rivers run to the sea, but the sea is not full. We welcome a diverse difference of opinion. Why would you want to live in some kind of tyranny where there's only one view? Well, I love the views on the left, the center, the right. There are many, many views. Great. Far be it for me to want one stupid view, because I'm not a tyrant or a dictator. That's not what we celebrate. But differences are to be celebrated. But when differences become divisions, the very bonds of our society start getting tested, frayed, and weakened. When differences become divisions, in other words, I know I have a different view than you. Let's debate it. Let's convince people. You can be a conservative today and a liberal tomorrow, or a liberal today and a conservative tomorrow, or a progressive at NDP today and a conservative the next. Doesn't matter. But divisions are when you lack the fundamental muscle of democracy, which is empathy. Some people have different views because they're from different places and different cultures and different experiences. Talk to someone who fled the communist dictatorship in the 50s of Hungary and ask why they're a conservative, because they've been ruled by a communist dictatorship. Ask someone why they're a progressive because they've seen government help and they see a benefit of big government. There are different views from different places. Great. Divisions are different. Divisions are no empathy. I don't understand you, and I don't like you. I'm going to throw rocks at you. And I'm like what happened to Mr. Trudeau the other day, yesterday. Someone called his wife a disgraceful word. And I'll play you the clip here. Trudeau got fed up. It wasn't his best moment on the campaign trail. But listen, this audio is muffled. This protester said, "Your wife is," and he used a disgraceful word. Trudeau takes his mask down and yells back. Now, not responding to trolls takes discipline. But listen to this. We get Trudeau there? Can we get Trudeau? Here's the Trudeau response. All right. He says, "Isn't there a hospital you should be going to bother right now?" I don't think we had that clip. Look, there's a division going on here. And we got to figure out how to get back to differences. Because divisions are going to rip us apart. Now, how does that apply to the anti-vaxxers? Look, people have asked me, and I'm torn about this, why don't you have more anti-vaxxers on your show to understand them? They've asked me. And I've had a bunch of anti-vaxxers on. But are there really two sides to science? We can debate the merits of the testing, the efficacy of the drugs, but in a deadly pandemic that for 18 months has shut down our economy, killed 27,000 Canadians, overwhelmed our ICUs, we know masks work, we know vaccines work, we know this. Are there really two sides? Look at Alberta and Saskatchewan. They by far right now have the highest rates of COVID. They account for more than half the COVID rates. No mask mandate. No mandatory passport. Like, it's a myth, folks. No government is forcing you to get this shot. This isn't about your freedom. You're never forced to take a mandatory shot. But it's within the legal rights of the government to enforce, to ask if you want to be a worker and come to work in a deadly, contagious pandemic, you got to be vaccinated. If not, we're not going to force you to take it, but you're going to have consequences. It's called an incentive. And when you incentivize people to take this vaccine, they take it. To travel, to get on. And in a deadly pandemic where the virus is killing people and it spreads through the air, we know scientifically that the vaccines are the best thing. So are there really, quote, two sides to that? 80% of Canadians, 80 more, believe that's the case. And a small number don't. And that number is a dangerous thing. And do we have time to educate them? In a deadly pandemic, when you can die in weeks and the ICUs are filled up, we need to factor one thing in: time. And we are running out of it. All right, I'm going to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Differences and divisions. That is the theme of the day today. Now, in Ontario, like in Alberta, there's something called the Catholic School Board. You know that. It's constitutionally protected. Back in 1867, Catholics have the right to have their own school board. And it has been controversial. I remember when John Tory was the leader, now the mayor of Toronto, he was a leader of the Progressive Conservative Party. He thought we should amalgamate the boards and just have one board, because the idea was, he said, you know, in this day and age, why should there be a separate Catholic school board? Why should all taxpayers pay for Catholics to get a religious education and not for other religions? If you're Muslim or Hindu or Jewish or evangelical Christian, you want to send your kids to a religious school, you got to pay for it. It's a private school. But if you're Catholic, you can get a taxpayer-subsidized school. But that is a third rail in Ontario. And why? Because it's protected by the Constitution. It's protected by the Constitution in 1867. And by the way, it's protected by the Charter of Rights as well. In the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, even though there are sections that make sure that there has to be religious equality, there also says the Charter of Rights and Freedoms does not interfere with the right to have pre-existing agreements for the Catholic School Board, which is kind of interesting. And the reason I'm talking about this today is because there is a young woman, a grade 12 student, who is an Orthodox Christian. She's 16 years old. And she wanted to become a York Catholic District School Board trustee, student trustee. But she was told, you can't because you're not Catholic. You're an Orthodox Christian, and only Catholics in the Catholic District School Board can become trustees. And she thought, it's unfair. And she and her dad launched a lawsuit. And they said, this is a violation of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Like, hey, why can't I? Even though I'm not Catholic, I should have every right to represent as a trustee. Here's the issue. The Education Act in Ontario is pretty clear about it. The right to have a Catholic school board represented by Catholics is protected by the Charter and the Education Act. And even though you have the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, please read Section 29, which says it does not interfere. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms does not interfere with essentially denominational school boards. So what do you make of this? Should lots of non-Catholics attend the Catholic school board? Lots of people enroll their kids who aren't Catholic but should only Catholics be allowed to be trustees? What's the legal view on this? Let's bring in Kara Zwiebel, Director of the Fundamental Freedoms Program at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Kara, a pleasure to have you on the program. Outline the case for just so people understand. A lot of people who are Catholic say, hey, this is protected. We love the Catholic School Board. Others say, it's 2021. It's unfair that Catholics get taxpayer-subsidized religious education and no other religion does, and it's a violation of my charter rights. How do you understand this?
Well, there's different interpretations and sort of understandings about the scope of denominational school rights and what it really means to have those rights entrenched in the Constitution. So some people would say, you know, well, let's look at how they existed at the time they were entrenched. And, you know, maybe if we didn't have student trustees at that time, then we don't, there's nothing we can sort of take from that period and bring it forward. I think despite the fact that these rights are entrenched in the Constitution, we have seen school boards, including Catholic school boards, you know, take more progressive approaches to policy, and in some cases doing things that, you know, a denominational school typically wouldn't do. And I think here, you know, you have an elected position. This is a person that whose peers, you know, wanted to serve on this board, wanted her to serve right on this board. And it seems hard to understand why, you know, her her faith is crucial to that position.
It may be hard to understand, but is it legally justifiable to say in the Catholic school board, if you want to be a trustee, guess what? You got to be Catholic. That's the nature of the board. We can't enforce it, and enforcing it is protected by the charter.
I don't think it would be. I mean, it'll obviously, we'll have to see what the court says about it. I can't forecast exactly what the court will do, but no, I think that in this case, There's nothing having a student trustee who's not Catholic serve on the board doesn't undermine fundamentally the denominational nature of the school, in my view. And you know, in any event, we've sort of progressed to a point where we recognize that lots of students that attend these schools are not Catholic. Those students don't have to participate in the sort of the religious education that comes along with attending a Catholic school. Some might choose to. And so similarly here, I think that there's room for this position.
But how do they enforce, like, so what designates a Catholic school then? The Catholic board will say Section 29 of the charter is specifically written to say nothing in the charter abrogates or derogates from any rights or privileges guaranteed by or under the Constitution of Canada in respect to denominational, separate, or dissentient schools. The charter does not affect the operation of religious schools that are protected elsewhere under the Constitution. This was protected under the Constitution of 1867. So whether you like it or agree with it or not, do they have the legal right to enforce Catholicism in whatever position they want?
I think that the case law that we've seen to date has recognized that denominational school rights doesn't necessarily include anything and everything that a Catholic school decides it includes. It might it might not include the question of whether a student trustee who unfortunately maybe probably has little power to actually direct the policy direction of the board has to be Catholic. I think that, again, these arguments have been raised at different points in time right. When we've allowed students who are not Catholic to attend these schools and to be exempt from participating in religious education. So people would have said that's a denominational school, right, that everyone who attends the school has to participate in these activities. That's not how things have worked. And so I think there is room for this argument to be made, and there's ample room, I think, for a court to find that this was not a...
So what can a Catholic... And I'm intrigued by this, and I know there's been case law on this, but there's, on both sides, what can they enforce then? Like, how does a separate school board, a denominational school board, enforce its unique religious characteristics then? Like, what can they do?
They can teach religion. They can teach religion to the students that choose to participate in those classes, or the parents who choose to have the students whose parents choose to have them participate in those classes. They can effectively proselytize, which is not something that a public school can do. So that to me is sort of at the core. And there's, I think, very good questions asked about whether we should, still have these schools around. I know you referred to it as a third rail, and I agree. No one wants to touch it, but there are lots of reasons that have nothing to do with religion for suggesting we'd be better off with a single public school system.
Right.
But either way, I think that the existence of these schools doesn't give them
the right. Okay, so that's interesting. Yeah. So. Okay, Kara Zwiebel, Director of the Fundamental Freedoms Program at the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Thank you, Kara. I want to get calls on this. What do you think? Should the Catholic School Board have the right to enforce this on a trustee or not? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Kara Zwiebel says there's lots of case law says, no, this is a bridge too far. What do you think? Next.
Helping you through these unique times. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. This is a really interesting debate. There's a 16-year-old girl. She's not Catholic. She's Orthodox Christian. She's in grade 12. She wanted to run in the Ontario York Catholic District School Board as a trustee. She was barred because she wasn't Catholic. She's suing. She says this is a violation of my Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So I've asked you all to weigh in. Should she have been allowed to run? She's not a Catholic. Now, the law is clear. The separate Catholic school, a denominational board, is protected by the Constitution of 1867. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms has a section 29 that says the Charter of Rights and Freedoms does not interfere with constitutionally protected denominational schools. But a lot of people already send their kids to Catholic school who aren't Catholic. And there's lots of case law that says, well, you know, Catholic schools can teach Catholicism, but it doesn't mean that it's infringing on the Catholic board to allow a non-Catholic to be a school trustee. So I'm asking you what your thoughts are. And we could get into the debate about the existence. It is what it is. It's protected. It exists. Whether it's should or not is a legitimate question. Whether it's fair or not is a legitimate question. But it exists. And when John Tory tried to say we got to save money by amalgamating the school boards and shutting that down because it's not fair, he got torched. Because politically it's a third rail, but it's still a good debate. 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010, or 7-1010. What's your thought on this? Now, I got a lot of people who send their kids to the Catholic school board, like Andre. What's up?
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. What's your take on this, Andre?
My take is I've seen an erosion of what is our school system, right from teachers not being Catholic to students not being Catholic and now board of directors, board of trustees not being Catholic. You should, by our laws, be mandated that you must be Catholic to be on the board, you must be Catholic to teach at these schools, and you must be Catholic to go to these schools.
You don't think anybody...
Let me just ask you,
and that's fair enough, and that's a Catholic board school system. It's you know... But what do you tell people who are not Catholic, who are paying for the Catholic school system? It's like your kids get to have a subsidized Catholic education, but no other religion does in the province. Why?
Specifically, I'd say because we created this country. That's why we're in the Charter of Rights. That Judeo-Christian values are what created Canada. You don't have to love it.
Right, but Catholics, let's be fair. Protestants don't get free, you know, the free religious education. Jews don't get it. Like, why of all the groups that were involved, I mean, Indigenous peoples were here too. Like, I'm trying to ask a serious question. Like, I understand the Catholic school board was protected because Catholics then were a minority, right? Not the majority. It was in a minority. So why should Catholics get in 2021 their religious education paid by everyone and no one else? Like, I'm just trying to ask you. You don't want anyone non-Catholics in there. So how do you justify, how do you say to someone who's, my tax dollars are going to pay for your kids' religious education, but your tax dollars are not going for my kids' religious education? Why is that fair?
It's probably easiest to sum up by those kids are going to have to go to a school at any rate, and they happen to be parents of tax-paying people who also pay taxes, and those kids go to those schools. And the part that really baffles me is that, you know, you sit there and there are certain segments of the population that wants to criticize or, you know, belittle what is and what has been signed into treaties and so on and so forth. But you look at those, and it's odd that they'll all acknowledge the same thing, is that they all want their kids, the kids that go to public schools. I've always heard parents saying, you know, I wish my kids could go there. And I turn around, I'm like, apparently they can, because they can be darn near anything and go to our schools. But if they acknowledge that our schools crank out smarter kids. You don't have to like that. That's a fact. You can actually
find... Listen. I'm glad you're proud of the Catholic school. Let me just push back, and I'm going to leave the call. Sorry. Don't pit kids against each other. No, Catholic schools do not put out, quote, smarter kids. There's no evidence of that. There might be benefits in different systems, But let's stop the superiority complex. Really, that I think is offensive to a lot of people whose kids do not go to the public school, to the Catholic school system. No, I'm sorry. The, quote, Catholic student, that there's no evidence of that. I really think we got to be real careful of that kind of talking down to others. This notion, we founded the country, we deserve better, our kids are smarter. You know, I'm not trying for division, but I got to be candid with you. I'm deeply insulted that you would say that. There's no evidence of that, Andre. And I think for parents listening, hearing you say that is really offensive. I'm going to tell you candidly, it's deeply offensive, that kind of superiority. Only Catholics should go. Our kids are smarter. Boy, that's what I'm talking about. It's one thing to be respect differences. It's another to have divisions. Remember I said that at the beginning of the show. Mike, what's up?
Hey, how you doing today?
That was a pretty painful comment, I'll be candid, but what's up?
Nothing much. I kind of agree with the beginning of what Andre said, but since our country has changed and so many things, we have so many moving parts going on right now. I'm a Catholic, by the way. I think we should let her run. It disturbs me that we have to go to a court to decide whether she can or not. Why don't we just let the electorate decide whether she can be in that position or not?
Yeah, I mean, look, thanks for the call. Rights aren't determined by the election. I think we got to be careful. Rights are determined by the charter and the Constitution. And I understand fully the constitutional protection for denominational schools. I've argued that. I've read Section 29 of the Constitution. I get it. But I don't want to vote because minorities are protected from the tyranny of the majority by the law. Catholics were a minority. They were their culture was protected in 1867. So I understand that. Like, if we just make the electorate vote, sometimes the electorate might vote against a minority. The whole idea of a Charter of Rights and Freedoms is to protect the rights of minorities against the tyranny of the majority. So I understand that. So I'm not trying to, this is not a, I mean, we're talking about the existence of a Catholic school board. They're still allowed to teach Catholic teachings if this young girl who is not a Catholic is a trustee. She attends the school. Boy, this is a really interesting discussion. And again, I think I'm glad we're having it because it's a real discussion. George, you're on the line. What's up?
Well, George? I'm an Orthodox Christian, but my wife's Catholic, and our three girls are Catholic and went to Catholic school. But I also believe that your viewpoint on this really depends on whether you believe that there should be a separate system. Personally, I would have a system where parents can direct their tax dollars to whatever religious school they want. I think that's the most fair thing. And I know that's a third rail, topic, but I think that's the most fair thing. But that's not going to happen because it's, protected in the Constitution. So that being said, I just don't think you can have people changing things from within. This 16-year-old girl can choose to go to a public school, can choose to be a student trustee. Her rights aren't affected, but it's fine to say you can go to a Catholic school because public dollars go there, and I support that. But I don't think that you can all of a sudden then just say, well, let's just get a whole bunch of non-Catholics to become trustees to change the system, because that's just an end around for basically saying we don't want a Catholic school system.
Yeah, listen, and that's why I asked the question. I appreciate the call. What's the line there? What can you protect and what can you not? Is a trustee really the, quote, slippery slope and a, quote, end around against the denominational specificity of the program? But this is why this is a very tricky issue. And publicly funded denominational schools have been part of Canada since 1867. But in 2021, to justify public dollars going for one religion is a real issue. It's not going to change. There's no political will to change it. But are certain elements of that justifiable? I just think this is raised. This is one of those questions that I just really appreciate the responses. I know it's a hot button issue, and I appreciate all of you. Lots more to come. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. Have you been following what's going on at Western University? It is horrifying. And again, my brother went there. My nephew went there. My nephew does go there. My daughter's now in her first year of university. And when I read this story, I was stunned. There have been charges about alleged sexual violence at Western and for a bunch of first-year universities, kids. Up to four young women, apparently, have reported sexual violence, and one young 18-year-old first-year student was killed in an off-campus assault on Saturday night. It's scary. And from what I've heard, and I've heard a lot, I don't know how much is verified, but I know a lot of kids on the campus. Again, my brother's son is on the campus. My wife's sister's son was a graduate there. One of my best friend's daughter is there right now. They're scared. We have heard all sorts of unconfirmed reports about drugging and different things. And then there's an assault. And I have heard from other kids saying, oh, this has gone on for a long time. That this is not just at Western. That the secret underbelly of a lot of these parties, stuff's going on. Really? Sexual violence, which I know is pervasive. I'm not naive about it. But there have been arrests made because there are Western students who said we've been sexually assaulted. And now there's been a death. I don't know if it's a murder, but Zianna Codadia is a University Students Council VP at Western Ontario. I want to get, what are the students feeling about this? Like, what's it like to be on campus with this? I remember being at McGill and the Ecole Polytechnique happened in my first or second, I think my first year. And that shattered our view of the world when a gunman came and massacred women at a campus very close to ours. What about this? Zianna joins me now. Zianna, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Zianna, you're in the University Students Council. First of all, a lot of people across the country listening might not know the situation. Can you give us a sense of what you know about the situation and what happened on your campus?
For sure. A lot of these investigations are ongoing, and we don't know specifics, but we have had social media reports of a lot of sexual violence over the course of the last several days. And students are exhausted. We're hearing about all of this violence. Many of our student leaders were involved in supporting students through some of these situations. So our community is heartbroken. Our community is disgusted, angry. Many of our students don't feel safe on campus right now. It's been a tumultuous last few days for our student community.
What would you hope the university would be doing right now, Zianna?
Well, one of the things that we're hoping for and hoping to work with the university on is addressing acts of gender-based sexual violence beyond the individual level. There needs to be a recognition of how, at a systemic level, our university can take up a more holistic framework that addresses proactive education, that addresses policy, procedures, prevention. Gender-based violence and sexual assaults are vastly underreported crimes, and they can't just be addressed in isolation.
Okay.
So we'd like to see the university take that seriously.
Now tell me something. Like, this is, we've now heard about charges against these four people who have allegedly sexually assaulted four women. Again, we don't know the details of this. Is this something that before this happened, Zianna, you're like, we know. This is happening all the time on campus. No one's talking about it.
Yeah, this is something that we know has been an ongoing issue at Western University. And actually, in the 2019 Student Voices on Sexual Violence report, we know that Western University had 71.6 percent of students say that they had disclosed experiences of sexual harassment. And this is actually the highest percentage of all the publicly assisted universities that were surveyed. So we know that this has been a cultural issue at Western University for years. This is something that we see continually on our campus, and it's something that needs to be addressed.
Okay, so again, I know this can be triggering, so, and if it is, let me know. But when you say that, like, what kind of things, I say this as a dad who's got a daughter in first year at McGill right now, and a nephew and a dear friend that goes to Western in undergrad, what are young women experiencing there? When you say they're 71% of experience, like, what kind of stuff? I've heard some really horrific stuff, but tell me what kind of things are getting reported. What are women experiencing there?
We don't have specifics on a lot of the incidents that took place over the course of this week, but I think it goes back to how, particularly for female students and for gender diverse students and for anyone really who belongs to a member of a marginalized community, there's a kind of fear that comes with moving through campus spaces, knowing and understanding that there are risks of violence and that there are risks for harassment. And, you know, this can look like a lot of different things. We know that gender-based sexual violence can take a lot of different forms. But I think that at the core of it, the experience of moving through campus, knowing and understanding that you're at risk for experiencing this kind of violence, is very difficult for students.
How are you, just tell me personally, like, what, you must be having conversations, Yana. Like, how are you feeling about all this? There's someone who was killed. There's assaults. Like, this must be scary.
It is. It is incredibly scary. And even though we don't know all the specifics of what has taken place, this has certainly heightened and highlighted the importance of prioritizing campus safety. I think it's unacceptable that our students are at risk of violence simply by walking through campus spaces.
So now what? Like, are you giving women at parties warnings? Like, hey, be careful of what you drink. Don't let you, like, I say this, I'm being candid. I say to my daughter, my wife says the same, don't let your drink out of your hand. Like, someone could, you know, put something in there. Go with a friend and make sure if someone's drinking too much or something, be careful, because you just don't, I'm not certainly blaming her, but they've got to, like, we don't know what to say to keep people safe. And they're going to go to parties. And, you know, it's never going to be the victim's fault, but you also want to give them street smarts, because, my God, it can happen.
Absolutely. And I think harm reduction strategies are part of that conversation for sure. What we're doing right now is everything that we can to share resources with our student body, to give students the tools that they need to access care if that's what they need in the moment. And we're also working closely with our students to learn more about what they'd like to see from us and what kind of advocacy they want. We know that it's important, as we're pushing for these changes with the university, to take up a survivor-centric approach. And we really want to ground all of our advocacy in the voices, needs, and experiences of survivors and of our student body. So today we've released a feedback form asking for students to let us know what they'd like to see done differently at Western. And we'll use their stories, their experiences, and anything that they'd like to share as a foundation for the work that we move forward on.
Ziana Kotadia, great to have you on the program, from the University Students Council VP at Western, which is going through an incredibly, powerfully disturbing case right now. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Yelling on the campaign trail, Quebec is changing. What is going on? Let's find out inside the war room.
Let me be perfectly clear.
Putting out misinformation.
And we hear that.
Misleading politics.
What's really important here?
Spreading it online.
Unequivocally.
The War Room.
Zane Velji, political campaign strategist, partner at Northweather, who worked with Calgary Mayor Nadine Nenshi and Rachel Notley, Natasha Carradine, principal at Navigator, national political columnist with Post Media, Tom Mulcair, CTV political analyst and former NDP leader. Hello to our daily War Room. How's everyone doing today?
What's up,
hey,
Evan?
What's going on?
Two big stories,
like a
right?
Hamster on a wheel, Evan. Hamster on a wheel.
Hamster on a wheel.
Running like crazy.
6 days of hamstring.
I'm hoping that we're actually moving forward, not just running round and round here. But are we? Let me start with you, Tash, then on that, because there are, I think there's two big stories today. There's always little stories on the trail, but the big stories are, is there something going on? Like, it's violent out there. It's weird out there. And there's a lot of yelling. I'm not talking about negative campaigning between the parties. Let's face it. We've all seen that before. I don't mind that, actually. But there's an anger, the protests around them, the hospitals, the yelling. I mean, you know, this guy yelling and saying something to Mr. Trudeau's wife, calling her a gross name. And here's how Trudeau responded. I tried to play this earlier. Here's how Trudeau responded.
Isn't there a hospital you should be going to bother right now?
Like, okay, that was probably not the greatest response.
But no, not really, no.
Someone called his wife a really dirty, dirty word. And so talk about that, Tash. Like, what is going on out there? Is this... I'm not talking about just the campaign. I'm talking about the country, the rise of the PPC and the anti-vax movement, this kind of stuff. Or is this just comme d'habitude, the usual?
Oh, no, this is not comme d'habitude. This is, it's a perfect storm. And, you know, Justin Trudeau kind of walked into it. I think that I think everyone underestimated the anger that is out there, yeah, and the fact that there is a place for it to park. And that is the PPC. It is transformed into a party for people who are angry at government, period. And in this case, because of the pandemic, there's the lightning rod of vaccination. So it really is a laser focus on this whole issue of government's role in people's lives. And that's where the debate has gone for these folks. And so there are people who will be rude and horrible and scream and do things that, you know, in civilized political debate, we have not seen in this country. We don't like that. I mean, I cast my mind back to 1988, yes, that far back, and the free trade election. And we saw some of this then, not quite as ugly, but still ugly. People screaming, you're selling out Canada. You know, Emile Mulroney was hit on the head by a sign at a rally. And, you know, stuff happened that we were kind of shocked and appalled. But it's been a while for that, and the anger went away. It didn't, you know, I worry this anger won't go away in the same way. I think that this is a phenomenon spurred on by the confluence of pandemic, economic insecurity, and anger at Trudeau personally, and we're seeing it now. And I think it's going to play a much bigger role in the result than anyone would have anticipated 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, Tom, weigh in on this. I think we were all naive to think that a kind of populism that we saw in the U.S. would never happen here. Like somehow there's a wall at the border. But no, like a virus, that stuff spreads. And when you have infringements for good or bad reasons, but the infringement of civil liberties that has been the hallmark of the pandemic for obvious reasons, it's a contagious, deadly pandemic. Not surprised this stuff's happened, are you?
No, and it brings us right back to the first question of the campaign. Why exactly are we having an election in the middle of the fourth wave of a pandemic? So that plays out rather badly for Mr. Trudeau and has since the beginning. Their calculation had been, this will last for 48 hours, maybe 72 hours, and then people will move on and realize we're in an election. But it's always there, hanging over every discussion. Some of the stuff back and forth has become like second-year high school taunts between O'Toole and Trudeau. It's really unusual, but what caught me off guard more over the weekend, I was watching the tennis like millions of other Canadians, and the ads that the Liberals were putting up were pure Republican style attack ads that I'm used to seeing, you know, watching American stations, because, you know, like everybody else in Canada, you get the American stations and you see the ads. I wasn't used to it. It threw me off. I remember, you know, at one point in an early election against Chrétien, the Conservatives had tried to do something similar with regard to Jean Chrétien's physical appearance, and it completely backfired on them.
Yeah, John Tory was actually the campaign manager for that. Do you remember? He actually defended it at the time. It may have very famous.
What's
surprising me the most is that it's actually seeming to work. I think that, you know, the Liberals have discovered that, you know, they're not going to win simply throwing stuff at O'Toole about anti-choice and anti-vax and pro-gun and so forth. So they're going to just use that type of American assault ad, and we'll see if it's going to work. I think it is working to a certain extent, especially in the big cities.
Zane, what's going on here? Look, negative ads work. We get it. And there are real – look, I'm – on the, there are real differences here. It's not like you can choose, you know, it's not like you can choose any politician as long as they come in, you know, vanilla, but in terms of politics, but there's differences here. But what do you make of the culture that's going on? There, like I had said earlier in the program, there's, Canada has been built on accepting differences. It seems that differences have evolved into divisions. Divisions are much more dangerous than differences.
Absolutely they are. And, you know, if I were to use a snappy phrase to describe what we're seeing, it's the YouTube comment section has come to life. And what used to be keyboard warriors behind a social media account anonymously and then not so anonymously, they found each other. These groups of people using digital technologies have been able to find each other, reinforce their behavior, revalidate their worldview. And to Tasha's and Tom's point, they now have a political party they can attribute with. You add that, you then add what Trudeau's been doing, which, by the way, when the Liberals do a postmortem on their campaign, one thing they got to realize that making Trudeau your attack dog was a wrong strategy, even if you win, because now you got him out on the stump looking at these divisions and pounding those fractures rather than bridging them like any leader should. So you add the confluence of all these factors, Evan, that folks online have found each other, they've made their behavior socially acceptable, that you've got a couple of leaders, I'd say at least, pounding the fractures rather than trying to bridge them. Is it a surprise that this is the state of our politics and perhaps
you're a strategist.
Democracy?
Who wins? Like who does this play to? These, like, who benefits from these? I mean, the wedges may be bad and corrosive to democracy, Zane, but who's benefiting?
Hate answering that question this moment, Evan, because this is personal for me, right? Like, this is like, these divisions are based, sure, on lockdowns, anti-vax, but they're also based on lines that I've got lived experience with, that people in our lives, like, this is like, I it's really hard for me, and I hate to make this sentimental.
No,
to answer
why?
This question.
Tell me why it's hard.
People are using our faith as a division and a hallmark of division for a long time. They're finding any fracture that they could. They're using conversations of even a moderator asking a question as signaling one side is racist to once again cement any opposition against Bill 21 to even question it going forward. These are things that are personal for millions of people in this country. So I'll give you the strategy answer because that's what I'm here for, and I won't get too sentimental.
No, you can. I think it's good if it's personal. It's because you give a crap. I like that.
I legitimately do. You know, I do this work not because it pays well or because of the glory to go on radio, but because I feel like it's a fundamental way to elect people that represent the inclusive, integrated Canada that I've got an ideal for. So it's really hard for me, to be totally honest, to see a prime minister out there in the stump who for 6 years talks about bringing people over and multiculturalism and integration, and then looks at a division in society, in this case lockdowns and vaccines or even Bill 21, and says, you know, there's a fracture there, let me pound it a bit more for political gain. One thing that I think happens beyond this election, regardless of what happens to Trudeau, he's hobbled in a real way on a credibility front, and I don't know what happens there on after with his ability to govern, but folks that have implied some trust in him on that particular manner of bridging rather than dividing, I would unfortunately say he's been a causal effect rather than a repairing one in this election.
Okay,
he's never been about bridging. I mean, he always talked the game about bridging, but he was always happy to exploit any division and to exacerbate divisions that weren't even necessarily there, but that, you know, had the sort of shadow effect, like the abortion question.
Tash, hang on. I want to come back to this because this notion of wedges and differences versus divisions and who's accountable for this. And it's happening in Quebec, too. And the Bloc has used a question, and we're going to talk about this, and Tash and Tom will weigh in. The election might have been altered on an English-language question about Quebec. How's it playing out on the differences and divisions? That's next. We are back in the war room with Zane Velji, Tasha Carradine, and Tom Mulcair. And did the election take a shocking and maybe irrevocable turn in the English language debate in a way that no one expected? Like, we always expected a knockout zinger, but not from the moderator. And Shachi Curl, the moderator of the debate, and the president of the Angus Reid Institute, asked Bloc Québécois leader Yves-François Blanchet, who was really there, I mean, the stakes were low, it's English language debate, about Bill 21 or the secularization law that bans some civil servants from wearing religious symbols like a hijab or a turban, or Bill 96 that would make French the only language needed to work in the province. Here's the question that has exploded in French media.
You deny that Quebec has problems with racism, yet you defend legislation such as Bills 96 and 21, which marginalize religious minorities, Anglophones, and Allophones. Quebec is recognized as a distinct society, but for those outside the province, please help them understand why your party also supports these discriminatory laws.
And by making it not, she didn't say laws that Jagmeet Singh called discriminatory and finely tuned to this kind of thing, Mr. Blanchet pounced.
Those laws are not about discrimination. They are about the values of Quebec.
And what happened next, Tom?
Well, what happened next is best described in an article that I will recommend our listeners find online in today's Gazette by André Pratt, a former senator and a former head of La Presse newspaper. The title is Ill-Advised, Ill-Informed Question Could Shake Up Election in Quebec. It's the beginning of her question that got so many people upset because she says to Blanchet, you deny that Quebec has problems with racism. If she had done any fact-checking whatsoever, she would know that one of the only senior politicians in Quebec to have ever come straight out and very clearly said that Quebec has systemic discrimination was Yves-François Blanchet. So it was sort of a double whammy, because then at the end she concludes that it is discriminatory. By the way, full disclosure, I have written at least a dozen articles saying that Bill 21 is discriminatory. I have written many articles saying that Bill 96, the new language law, is not only discriminatory, it's unconstitutional on the face of it. It takes away the right to use English and French equally in the courts in Quebec. So I know where I'm coming at on this. But what happened with that question was it just set up a perfect storm, to use Tash's expression from before. And it's a firestorm that's constantly being fed. Look, this is Tuesday. This took place last Thursday during the English debate. And I thought it was going to die down after a couple of days. If you look at today's lead editorials, whether you're in the Journal de Montréal or in Le Devoir, all you're seeing is people who are outraged at this. What has it meant for the election? The Bloc is rising rapidly. I got Bloc information over the weekend that they were having no trouble pulling their vote for the advance polls. I am also told by a senior conservative that there is a riding called La Beauce, which is right now held by the Conservatives, that will probably be won by a certain Maxime Bernier. So hold on to your hats, because
wow,
there is so much happening right now. There are Liberals in places like Vaudreuil-Soulanges, a very affable, fantastic young Liberal MP named Shefki. He's probably going to bite the dust. Another great young guy in Quebec City in the Louis-Hébert riding, his name is Joel Lightbound. This is the future of that party. You know, they're fluently bilingual, they're super bright, they're energetic. He's going to bite the dust. And sitting minister Diane Laboutier and Gaspé will lose in all likelihood. So this is the shape of things right now. It's only been about a four-point jump for the Bloc, which is a lot in such a tight election. Trudeau's numbers with French-speaking Quebecers have just tanked. And he's going to hold on to all of his Montreal base, because those are English ridings. I live in the West Island of Montreal, a mostly English area, or predominantly at least. And they win those seats by 20,000 votes, but it's just one seat, yeah. You know?
It's funny, though, Tash, that the question was from Shachi Curl, and I know the Bloc has used this. Premier Legault has pounced on this. And yet, Trudeau's getting, as Tom says, this could really hurt the Liberals, certainly the Conservatives there, and help the Bloc. And this could decide the election. What do people, but as Tom said, calling this law discriminatory, something Jagmeet Singh has done. All of the leaders have said that, though they've treaded carefully not to challenge it. Like, why was this so different? What happened here?
What happened here was that Shachi Curl was the embodiment of English Canada, slapping Quebec upside the head. That was what this came down to. And so this election will be actually decided by three ego trips. The first of the Prime Minister calling an election when he didn't have to. The second, Maxime Bernier's vanity project that is now riding the polls right up like a rocket for the PPC. And the third is Sachi Curl trying to look smarter than the people she was questioning. Her performance has been roundly criticized. I don't need to add to that, but at this question in particular, she didn't know what she was talking about, but she wanted to look like she knew, and the result was that she basically was like a bee sting to the head, and all of Quebec reared up and said, "You don't diss us like that," and this is what happened. So,
wow.
Yeah, all these things are working together in unison, and the result of this is going to be a much more fractured polity at the end of the day, and probably a little minority again. So there we are.
Well, and I just want, and Zane, over to you, but when Tom said, Maxine, for those people not following riding by riding issues, which is everybody, the Beauce is the riding that Max represented when he was a conservative, and it's the riding his father represented. He did lose it when he bolted from the party. If he wins it back, you know, this... You know, what some regard as a barnacle on the good ship democracy as the People's Party suddenly gets on board and becomes a crew member.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. And we're seeing that the PPC rise, as I talked about yesterday. Yeah, might have an anti-vax and anti-lockdown core, but certainly the second and third rings of support are much broader, much more mainstream, much more, as others have called it, painfully normal. With the folks that are jumping onto this this bend that is the PPC. And maybe to Tasha's earlier point, which I know we drove by, I think it's an excellent one. Maybe what unites them is less so ideology, obviously some, but more so anger, more so tone. They might be aligned and kind of gelled together with tone. On the Sachi Curl question, let me just say, you know, I did not think the question, once again, I sit here as a unilingual Albertan, right? So this tells you, you know, where I'm coming from, was not discriminatory. But of course, the fact that you know, Blanchette saw that as a watermelon on a T-ball stick was just literally, you know, hit it out. I don't know, that's a horrible analogy, by the way, now that it comes out of my mouth. But he saw it and he said, let me torque this for what it's worth. And so he shifted it into a question about racism. And then, of course, as soon as you go there, you have everyone, including Trudeau, O'Toole, Legault, jumping in on it. The PQ are now fundraising off of memes of Sachi Curl. This will keep volleying until Election Day. And unfortunately, you know, no one had this on their bingo card, but it might be moderator question in the center of that bingo card that could decide this thing, at least regionally in Quebec.
It just shows
go ahead,
Tom.
When you know that the Liberals had counted on stealing at least 10, perhaps as high as 15 seats from the Bloc, because they figured that the Bloc's 30-plus performance in 2019 was a historical fluke, now they're looking at actually losing seats overall in the province of Quebec. And any thought of a majority government, of course, is way off, is off the table. And now they're fighting for their lives unexpectedly.
Do they benefit from any vote split, though, Tom? Sorry, Devin, I'm taking your job.
There will be interesting vote splits because there are four parties out there vying, and there'll be an unusual place like Sherbrooke or Trois-Rivières where an unexpected party will come up the middle and get 26.5% of the vote, and that'll be enough to win in some odd ridings here and there.
But Tom,
the Liberals are the ones who are suffering.
But Tom, is there any salience in that? Sorry, Zane, I'm stealing your fancy words. No, I'm just kidding.
Excellent word.
I don't even know what that means. I just wanted to try to imitate you since you were doing it too.
I teach in the social sciences. I use that word three times a day.
I put salience on my pizza because it's spicy. Okay.
That's what the zeitgeist is all about.
That is what it's about. And that is why I put that metaphor right on a T-ball stick like a salient. No, I'm just kidding.
Salient watermelon?
Like a salient watermelon.
There we go.
I think we should have a band called the Salient Watermelons.
That's okay. A great name.
There is one.
It's this one. How we want to be introduced tomorrow.
Here they are, the Salient Watermelons. Zane, Tasha, and Tom, the Salient Watermelons. Thank you so much.
Salut, bye.
We're going to talk, by the way, you mentioned the rise of the PPC. Frank Graves is going to join us. This is for real. This could have an effect. We're going to really dig into that. What is going on beneath the surface? Frank's going to join us in a minute. Stay right here on the Evan Solomon Show.
Making sense of the latest news. You're listening to the Evan Solomon Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Let's get into the People's Party. They were not included in the debate because it didn't make the threshold. The threshold was you had to have at least 4% or a member of parliament within 5 days after the election call. They didn't have it. They screamed foul. Wow, we need to get... Well, they're growing in popularity. riding on a wave of anti-vax protests that have become a key part of this campaign. The People's Party are polling anywhere from 5 to 8%, depending on where and who you believe. And the question is, what impact are they going to have? What's going on here? Why are they attracting support? Who do they drag support from? Can Max Bernier, the one-time conservative who came within one ballot, be leading the conservatives, then left in a huff, took his toys, went home, then got blanked, bageled, shut out in the 2019 election, but said, no, I'm going to stick around. Now he's coming back. Can he win a seat in the Beauce where he's run before? How do you understand this? Let's bring in Frank Graves. He's the president of ECOS Research Associates. He's been looking at this stuff for a long time. Frank, how you doing?
I'm good, Evan. How are you?
Well, I'm confused. I'm trying to understand it, and that's why I call you. You know, like when when I'm like, I got to understand this. You've been looking at this stuff for a long time, Frank. Tell me the rise of the People's Party. Where do you track them, and where are they gaining support?
Yeah, they're certainly rising, it's interesting because they also have folks who feel very similar to them within the Conservative Party. And that's one of the challenges that Mr. O'Toole faces in moving the party to a more of a moderate center position. There is a considerable portion of the party which actually looks more to the kind of like Northern Trumpist, which I don't think recognize. And it's already seen some of those individuals and those voters moving out and joining the People's Party, which has become the rallying a spot for those who are anti-vax, anti-vax passport, anti-mask. And they have a very distinct demographic, political, and psychographic profile. Most of them have come from the Conservative Party. They've drawn some support from other parties, but it's relatively picayune compared to the about 55% of the people that are currently saying they're voting for the People's Party voted for the Conservatives in the last election. They have some first-time voters as well. It's a surprisingly younger group. It's under 50. It's male, a little more common in rural areas, college but not university educated, off many working class. And they're very angry. They're mistrustful of institutions and science, believe the pandemic's been exaggerated. And they're really very angry. And so this pandemic has provided a bit of a magnet for this party to grow.
So where are they growing? Like some say, look, they're growing in, let's say, Alberta and Saskatchewan, where they have some of the lower vaccine rates. And that won't really impact because a lot of those seats are going to be won by conservatives in a huge plurality. So instead of being won by 25%, they might be won by a conservative by 15%. Or are they actually vote splitting consequentially in tighter ridings, Frank?
I believe they will be a factor. I don't think they're going to win any seats. Mr. Bernier may or may not win his seat. We did have them as high at one point as 11%. Now we have them in the 7.5% range, which is not enough to win any seats, but certainly can be a source of consternation because I have them distributed in areas where that will become problematic for the Conservatives. And it wouldn't be so much in Alberta and Saskatchewan, but it would be a factor in Ontario, possibly British Columbia, because they basically have support, even though they have a very distinct demographic base. Regionally, they're present pretty well across the country.
Yeah, it's interesting. Max Bernier just posted a picture in Fort McMurray, packed house.
No masks.
No masks.
Just as a vivid illustration of just how different they are. We've been tracking vaccinations for a variety of reasons since for some time. And most Canadians, as you know, are vaccinated. The incidence of members of the People's Party who are vaccinated is 30%. It goes, in contrast, say, for NDP, Liberals, and Bloc supporters, it's 97%.
So is Trudeau driving – he's made this a big political issue, and I know Mr. O'Toole's had a different position, doesn't want to vaccinate all his candidates, but he said, I want testing. Who's driving this division here, Frank? And is Trudeau trying to benefit off this wedge, or is he actually creating an opportunity for Mr. Bernier?
Well, I don't think whatever Mr. Trudeau's views of Mr. Bernier, the fact that he's grabbing a lot of votes which otherwise would go to the Conservatives, the political calculus there probably works pretty well for Mr. Trudeau. But at the same time, we're finding that the vast majority of Canadians who have fallen into the vaccinated category now believe that the fourth wave is principally a product of those who've chosen not to vaccinate. And so their patience with this is exhausted. And the splits which you would see on those views, for example, in the Conservative Party, they're divided. The Conservatives are about 50-50 on whether or not we should have a vaccine passport. If you move into the other parts of the political spectrum, it's like 90-10. If you move into the People's Party of the spectrum, it's 10-90. It's the other way around. No, it's actually, there's nobody that's voting for the People's Party that would support a vaccine passport. So, yes, it's become a really emotionally engaging and tremendously divisive issue, but it's not like this, the fault lines are dividing Canadians in the middle. It's like 85.
It's really, but it could be consequential. Like, this is the thing. It could be. Now, is this a lasting thing? Or let's say the pandemic ends in a year. I don't know. Let's hope it ends sooner. But does this just sort of burn out, or are we seeing something else? Like, to quote the old phrase, something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. Now, maybe it's clear to you.
Well, I think it's much deeper and more troubling than the debate about the vaccine, which is obviously the critical issue of our time right now. But if you were to line up their positions of these groups, and as I said, extends into the about half of the Conservative base as well, it expresses an outlook that we called ordered populism, which is really what was critical in electing both Donald Trump and Brexit. And that forces at work here as well. There's a sense in Canada of sneering and denial that this is not something that we have to worry about. We're immune. We're not. And I've measured it very carefully, and it was a very potent predictor of the last election. And it's a very potent predictor, will be a very potent predictor of this election. But beyond the issue of the vaccine passport, you'll find harshly polarized views on things like climate change. Is it real? What should we do about it? You'll find stark divisions on issues about whether we need to address social issues like racial injustice or systemic racism or Indigenous reconciliation. So the country is very, very divided in ways where there's very little common ground. So whatever is the result of this election, this harsh polarization, which also brings in what some call effective polarization, which is new and intense. And that's the degree which you really can't stand the guy on the other side of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
It's been rising dramatically in both Canada and the United States. It actually, interestingly, hasn't been going up in Europe. So this is a unique problem that's going to plague us for some time.
Yeah, as I keep saying it all day, Frank Graves, which is Canada used to thrive and celebrate and protect differences, but differences are becoming divisions, and divisions are a whole different world. Once you're in divisions, it's different than just, you know, you're different, I'm there, everyone's different, great. Different views, great. Once you get into divisions, man, politics changes, and it's a lot different. All right, well, we'll find out. We got 6 days to find out how this plays out. Frank Graves, president of Ecos Research Associates. Here's a division, and I hope it just ends up as a difference. Frank, thanks, my friend. Good to have you back on the program.
Always nice chatting with you. Stay well.
You too. Stay safe, Frank. Stay safe. All of us. Listen, we know how to stay safe. I'm sorry. We know that vaccines are the best way to stay safe. If you can get vaccinated, why wouldn't you? I just can't believe there's a debate about this. The reality, the world has basically presented the argument. We'll have that debate next on the program. Stay with us.
As your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
Welcome back to the show. Okay, listen, let's get off politics for a second. You know, I go for my morning run with the guys every morning. And often when I run, there is one man, I want to shame him. There's a guy that I see often running, and he always runs with no shirt on. Older guy. It's not like it's the gun show there. Like, he just runs with no shirt. That's his jam, the no-shirt runner. And back on September 6th, credit to the Toronto Star, they had a story by Christine Sismondo that said, is it okay to go running without a shirt? And there's a lot of shirtless runners. And, you know, you see him sweat. And then it struck me, like, I don't know. I never run without a shirt. Is it okay when you see someone running to run without a shirt? Or what about, you know, like, play tennis without a shirt? Or, you know, shirts and skins in basketball. We used to do that all the time, right? All right, shirts and skins, your skins, your shirts, and you know, one team has to take off the shirt. It's okay to do that. It's always gross when you're playing ball and guy with no shirt on kind of jumps in your face. You get a little pit in your face. Ugh. Happens. 1-855-633-1010. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Is it okay to run without a shirt? Go shirtless in your sports? 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. When you see someone running with a shirt, are you like, ah, come on, man? Or, like, for women, there's a lot of the sports bra runners. Too much or not? 1-855-633-1010. About a month ago, I will now admit something. About a month ago, it was the weekend, and it was a heat wave, and I was running, and I went for a long run, and I got back, and it was like smoking hot. I was in my driveway, and I took off my shirt because I was about to go inside.
Tarps off, boys.
Tarps off. And so I take my shirt off, and I'm walking inside, and then one of my neighbors and her son, who happens to be one of my son's best friends, we know them well, she drives up, and they're like, oh, hi, Evan. Question about, like, the kids were doing something, like hockey or something. They, you know, they play sports together. They play football. They play hockey. They do everything together. And so there I was with no shirt. So I walked out to the car, and it was, like, super embarrassing. Like, you know, here she is, my buddy's wife, who I know, friends with my wife. I've got no shirt on. And we were going to see this couple later that week for a drink. And then, so when we saw them, we actually picked them up. And I'm like, I have to apologize for talking to you with no shirt. And she's like, yeah, I was like, you know, wow, you know, you were no shirt. And her son was like, yeah, you know, you had no, I was so embarrassed. I was like, I don't normally run with no shirt. She's like, I was wondering, but you're really confident. And I was appalled. My wife was like, why did you take off your shirt? I said, I took it off because I thought I was going inside. Spencer, what do you think of the tarps off runner? Spencer, you on the line? What do you got?
Hello. Hey, can you hear me?
All yeah, right. I got you.
I would say that it's definitely a no-go for me. Each morning now since COVID hit, I've gotten into the habit of waking up early morning, going for a run. And it seems each and every time that I step foot out of that door, one of my neighbors, who's an elderly gentleman, he's around 70 years old, I assume, but good on him for going for a run, but not good on him for going without a shirt on.
He tarps off and you can see it.
Oh, absolutely. And my breakfast is absolutely gone probably the second I step foot out that door. But, you know, I almost have to thank him in a way, because each time I go out for that run, it's almost like my motivation to keep on going, because I have this big guy that's behind me. And let me tell you, he is no silver fox, but there's nothing to look at there. And I'm running and I'm going. I'm trying to get away from this guy, but he keeps going. He's pretty persistent. He keeps going, and he'll actually run for longer than me. And I'm like, I got to take a break and go inside, go have my coffee, and just kind
that of. That is awesome. Well, you know what the thing is? I kind of, all right, well, thanks for the call, Spence. I like the body confidence there, right? He's got the Jell-O tree going great. He's still out there. I don't do it, you know? You know, I'm doing my workout. I'm trying to stay fit, but I don't go tarps off. Dave, is it okay to run without a shirt?
Yes, it is okay, Evan.
And it's perfectly natural. He wants to get some tan on his body, maybe the fresh air on his body while he's running. It's perfectly legal. In fact, it's perfectly legal for women to run around with no top on if they so choose. And I think that sometimes there's no shirt, and I've heard it in other kinds of commentaries, it's a part of body shaming that, you know, a fat, ugly old guy with no shirt. But if he was a nice, trim, svelte guy with a real bust, they could be saying, wow, look at that. It's a matter of perspective sometimes. And if a person wants to run with no shirt, it's perfectly legal. It's his choice. Why not? And if, whether I like it or not, that's, you know, maybe sometimes people are looking to be offended by something. Too bad on them.
Yeah, listen, I don't think anyone's offended. Yeah, it's funny. Dave, a great call. I sometimes wonder, like, why not? It's hot. Maybe I should do it. Like, lots of people I know, you know, rip the shirt off. It is, you're right. It's usually the guys that are hitting the gym. Jeff, okay? You don't mind?
What's that? Sorry?
What's your take, Jeff? Tarps off or not?
Oh, absolutely a non-issue. I mean,
love it. Do you run?
What's that, sorry?
Do you run tarps off? Like if you're a runner, would you just go like, screw it? I'm going to take shirt off, shorts, go.
If it's hot out, absolutely.
Nice, nice.
Like vitamin D, the whole rest of it, right? And for those elderly people that choose to do that, more power to them.
Love
it. You know, if you're confident and you're doing your thing, have at her. There's nothing wrong with it.
All right, go for it. All right. You should see the text I'm getting. A lot of people are like, go for it. They should do it. And some like, listen, I don't care if you do it, just for the record. I don't care. I love it. Go for it. I have at it. This is not about offend. I'm just like, I got to say, when I was like chatting to my buddy's wife with my shirt off, it just seemed, now, which is funny because I'd go swimming. No problem. You know, hey, take off my shirt, go swimming, go to the beach. Yeah, great. No problem. I don't know why, but you know, you're all gross and sweaty from a run. I guess so. Like, I got to get into it. I got to say, I like it. Frank, what's up?
Hey, Evan.
What's your take on this, Frank?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I took my shirt off on Friday, and the guys I work with all started laughing that we were pavers. We're asphalt workers, and I'm almost in my 60s now. I don't really have the good body that I had back in those days. But we all took them off back in the day, and it was funny because, like you're saying, Friday I took mine off, and everybody was like, what? Because, you know, I haven't done it maybe in 30 years.
Here's what I say. I think I'm convinced. What are we so worried about? We've been through the bloody pandemic. You want to take your shirt off and go for a run? Go for it. Who gives a crap? You're working?
It's like the guy said before. If the guy looks good and he's, you know, later, older man, not like me. I wouldn't do it if I had to run.
But you know what? Do it. You know what? You've convinced me. Like, you know what? What are we so worried about? Life's short. If we get a hot day here, you want to run, you want to work with your shirt off.
Tarps off, boys.
Come on, man. Tarps off. I'm convinced. I may do it. All right. Keep listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network. I'll see you on Power Play tonight at 5:00.